Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 827. We have some Nerdist Community Corkboard things. These are Nerdist happenings from the Nerdist community, like you, Nerdist community member. You can send us events@nerdist.com, your thing, whatever it is. Please don't be a big company. Just be a person with a thing or an organization or something, or just someone who wants to say hi. Like, for instance, we got this email. My name's Clinton. I'm a soldier with the U.S. Army. I've been a fan of the podcast since the Talking Cat episode, which is going back. Thank you, Clinton. And I just want to thank Chris, Jonah, and Matt for helping me laugh through some of the darkest times during my 2 deployments to Afghanistan. Clinton, thank you so much for your service to this country. Thank you for listening to the Nerdist Podcast. We throw support back in your direction, and the Sister Wives and I send you hugs. They've allowed me to speak for them in such matters. So, hey, I'm Jonah. I'm Matt. Hugs. Oh, boy, that was really bad. Don't tell them I did that. Don't worry, they don't listen. They're not going to know if you don't tell them. Also, comedian Nick Turner has his Comedy Central half hour and the debut album coming out September 30th. The special will premiere Friday the 30th at 12:30 a.m., and the album will come out the same day, but it's available for pre-order now on iTunes. So check him out. This episode is Mr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, which I think this is a three-peat? Or did he appear somewhere else? Maybe a fourth? I don't know. He's been on a lot. But I love Neil a lot. I am so excited and honored that I get to be friends with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And Star Talk, which is the TV version of his podcast, is back on Nat Geo, on National Geographic Channel, Mondays at 11, 10 Central. Mayim Bialik's going to be on the next episode. I think I am on the next episode. And I believe Summer Ash, who was on a few episodes ago, this was the episode that we met on where I said, hey, you got to come on the podcast. And then she came on. So Star Talk, Neil deGrasse Tyson, the TV show, Nat Geo. Also, I guess, just promoting science in general. But I love when Neil comes on. It's, you know, and because they're ones where I really, really, really extra have to focus. Because he knows a lot more than I do, and I don't want to sound like an idiot when he comes on. So I try my best to keep up with him. But the man has a very large brain. I'm jealous of his very large brain. But he uses it for good, thankfully. So Neil deGrasse Tyson. Here's the Nerdist Podcast number 827 with the return of Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I will wear a Star Talk tie on the show. Congratulations on Star Talk, the TV show, which I did.
Yes.
And it was really fun.
Well, plus, you were like in the first year of the show.
Yeah.
When we traded interviews, that was like early days when we were still under an NSF grant.
Yes, so, yes, you were doing that, and then we produced with you guys the YouTube version of Star Talk. But right. Now you're all fancy,
right?
Now,
well, yeah, yeah, right. I forgot there's a whole middle section.
Now
there.
You're fancy. Yeah. And you're actually on Nat Geo.
Yeah,
and and it was. I loved the show because it's in the planetarium. We shot it in the... Did you shoot all the episodes in the planetarium?
All the episodes in the Hall of the Universe.
And it was nice. Yeah. People just came to hear about science and talk, and it was fun. And then I became pals with...
Are we on now? Are we?
Yeah, this is happening.
This is happening.
I
this
became pals with Summer Ash,
mm-hmm.
and then I had her on the podcast.
Isn't that a cool name, Summer Ash?
It's the best. Yeah,
it's the best name ever.
The best name for someone with... And we talked about her... we talked about science, and we talked about her incredible heartbeat and all these amazing things. So how... Now that you've completed the... you've taped all the episodes, I assume.
No, we have a few more for the season. Right, right. But several are in the can, and we keep going. Well, we know who all the main interviews
sure,
are.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a fun group.
And...
Eclectic, and you know, some high level celebs you've all heard of, and others who are celebrity by title,
right?
If not by name,
yeah.
Like, I don't know how much of a household name Ash Carter is, but he is the Secretary of Defense of the United States of America. We got him on there.
Of this country?
Yes.
Oh, that's crazy.
This country. And then you learn that he's trying to introduce cyber as a fundamental part of the future of our security. So it's just fun speaking to people. And getting out of that conversation all the ways that technology and science is mattering in their lives, even if they're just simple, quote, just simple celebrities who
sure.
are known for acting or for singing or even politicians. There's always a geek underbelly that we can find.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is there any – I mean, how – soon before the robots become self-aware. I mean, they're going to become self-aware at some point, and then we're useless to them.
Yeah, we are. They would be done with us. We are a contamination.
We're a contamination.
No, I got it right. We're a virus.
We are, but yeah. Yeah, so that's your matrix.
You got to say the matrix, right?
Yeah.
You're
a virus. Mr. Anderson.
You're a virus.
You're a virus. And we are the cure. You're a disease.
And we are the cure.
And then they play their. Then he plays his Cure cover band. That would have been amazing. That would have been a great joke in The Matrix. Not that funny of a movie, though. How are you? How many episodes of Star Talk did you guys do for Nat Geo?
So we'd still do 50 a year for audio.
Right.
And, but then, so with the relationship with Nat Geo, they cherry pick us, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We will take those 20 out of your 50, and those get elevated to television.
Still a lot of episodes.
Oh, still a lot. Oh, still a lot. But they have the full production value of a TV set. Done in our Hall of the Universe, the Cullman Hall of the Universe, one of our great donors to the museum. And so they get 20. And so some of them are the highbrow celebs. Others are just some other folks that have sort of deep significance in, on the landscape. But we're loving it. And it's the fact that it's, you know, radio, podcast. Excuse me. Radio, podcast, book.
Yep.
Stage and screen, you know, so we are pleased, delighted that this material has this level of access into pop culture.
And what is you're largely responsible for that. I mean, you and Bill Nye and people who can communicate science well.
So here's what I thought this through, and I realized it's not because I'm communicating science well. There are plenty of people who do that. So what's different? The difference is I have retained enough running awareness of pop culture that it is the pop culture scaffold on which I clad the science that we unravel.
That's just the way people communicate now. Pop culture.
Exactly, exactly. And you don't have to dumb it down, the science, because they already came in with – you don't have to teach them the pop culture.
Right.
That's the definition of pop culture. They already know who Beyonce is. They know what football is. They know, you know, who the Kardashians are. So if they come in with that and we analyze that scaffold and say, here's science that can fit this section and that section and the other section, you walk away, I'd like to think, not with so much an enhanced appreciation of science, but an enhanced appreciation of the pop culture stuff you already cared about.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that science infuses everywhere. And then you'll recognize that science is not just some subject you can step around or walk under or ignore. It is a fundamental part of what it is to be alive in modern civilization.
Well, it's literally just the pursuit of knowledge. It's just the pursuit of knowledge.
Yes, but if the knowledge connects to other things you care about more,
yes,
it's better than knowledge.
Right.
It's enlightenment.
And you're allowing people an emotional window.
It's better than knowledge.
It's better than knowledge.
Enlightenment.
Well, yeah, because knowledge itself just doesn't really have any value
right.
until it's applied.
Exactly. What can you do with it? And how can you imbue it with meaning?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so yeah. What in those 20 topics, what is it in this past year that has excited you, or what have you learned, or what, you know, how has your perspective changed?
Yeah, I love learning. Right. So some of them have cosmic relevance. So by the way, if we ever have a scientist as the main guest,
mm-hmm.
it's not generally because of their science. It's because there's something else they do that has very high pop culture value.
Oh, right.
And it turns out one person, they are one and the same in that regard, and it's Jill Tarter, who
mm-hmm.
you may know who she is. She she was the co-founder of the SETI Institute.
Oh, yes.
And her
oh.
whole life has been devoted to looking for aliens.
I had that screensaver in like 2003.
Oh, there we are. You're talking
like
about
your SETI screensaver
SETI
running in the background. You
SETI
know?
At home, helping us try to decode signals from,
I don't think I helped.
From deep space.
I don't think I
well,
helped.
It was a test of parallel programming. I mean, where all computers are doing the same task
mm-hmm.
on a different piece of the data at once. With a computing power that had no precedent. So it was a brilliant idea. It was beautifully executed, and everyone wanted to participate. Millions of people wanted to help us find little green men. So that's a case where we're talking about aliens in Hollywood, the movie Contact.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a fun conversation, and we get to put in the science in all the places that it fit.
Yeah. Do you think where does science run the risk of a scientist or an educator when you say you love learning? I'm sure you come up against people sometimes who feel like, well, they, you know, I'm very smart. I'm a scientist. I know it all, and are not open to new information, new ideas, confirmation bias.
By the way, you know how that happens. You have to learn how to be closed-minded. I have figured out because when you're in school, in college, high school, especially college, you go to class to learn.
Right.
That's the whole point of your life. You don't say, I'm going to sit ossified in my seat and deny everything the professor tells me. No. You are there to learn. Something happens between graduating college and adulthood where maybe we think education is, I now know all I need. And henceforth, I don't need to learn.
Right.
And that's where the ossification occurs.
Well, I think it just takes energy. It takes energy.
Energy, you're right.
And
right.
It takes energy. And so, you know, if there is a law, if there's a law of emotional conservation of energy, you know, I think sometimes people just kind of – they get set in their lives and they kind of assume this is how much energy I have.
I have to concede that because mm-hmm. after college, maybe you get married, you
yes.
have kids, you're paying the rent,
right.
the mortgage, and life kicks in.
Right.
And you don't have time to say, let me think I don't know anything.
To have your mind challenge. To be another challenge. Like, I can't even get my kids to do his homework. I can't fucking worry about whether or not this concept of space and time is flowing together.
Right, right. So let me lighten up on the folks who came out close-minded. But I missed a point that you had said in the StarTalk episodes. My favorite ones are in topics that I have no expertise in because then I learn.
Mm-hmm.
That's my point.
Oh, that's great.
And so when that happens, and we usually bring in an expert if I don't have that expertise to supplement the main interview, which is the celebrity. And I don't know if you know fully the reason why we interview celebrities. It's not because that matters really, except that they have followings.
Sure.
And their following doesn't always know about – they don't always know about what might be the science underbelly interests of their celebrity.
Mayim Bialik is a perfect example. People go, I love Big Bang Theory. Oh my gosh, she's actually
– Exactly, a PhD in neuroscience.
Neuroscientist.
She's not neuronic. She's a neuroscientist.
Maybe I could pursue that, or maybe
exactly.
I should look into that
and
because I love
her. She's one of our guests this year, and a great interview with her. Was it this year or last year?
It was this year because that was the episode I was on.
Oh,
and
okay,
you had already done the piece with her, and it ran.
Yes,
we watched it.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Right. So, but that's an example of a celebrity who's she's attached to the number one show on television.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't know her name straight out, the fact that she exists as a character in the number one show was value to us all.
Yeah.
So I love learning about that just as a host. But I also get to keep a foot in pop culture so that I have a sense, however successful or not, of what you're going to care about when I ask those questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that way we're all just kind of in it together learning and seeing how science matters to everyday life. And I only realized after the fact that that's what I was doing, because people say, oh, you explained the cosmos. So no, it's not it. It's that you care about this other thing and I'm giving you added ammo to care about it even more.
You're transferring your emotional attachment to that thing, and that just sort of that. And that also makes people willing. It opens the doors. It makes them willing.
And they're willing to come back for more. During the Super Bowl, there was a field goal attempt that hit the right upright and missed. And I said, wait a minute, where's the stadium? And what's the angle, the orientation? So I quickly did a fast back-of-the-envelope calculation. And then I tweeted a completely ridiculous but true statement. And I said, if... And I forgot which team was kicking the thing. So the tweet was, if Earth rotated 10 times faster, but in the opposite direction, then they would have made that field goal, because the Coriolis force of the Earth would have guided it through the uprights.
But anything less than that, that guy missed that kick.
Anything less than that, it was a goner.
That's what he's going to tell us from. You guys, the Coriolis effect was against me. I would have. It wasn't my fault.
I could have been somebody.
I could have done it. But I'm interested. I become more and more fascinated now with humans and their idea of
humans. Like, you're not a human.
Yes.
Can you speak like you're one of us, please? These humans. You're like Spock.
When I say humans, and I put myself. I mean, yes. I mean, this is something that I do as well. I mean, it's about humanity. But I've been really, really, really interested lately in a couple of ideas. Did you read the Dunning-Kruger study?
What's that?
The Dunning-Kruger study was...
I don't recognize the name.
They took a sampling of people, and what they discovered is people who know less will believe and claim they know more, and
yes.
people who yes. know more will actually go, I don't really know anything.
Right. Exactly.
And
they dig their heels in.
Or for people who... Even in the face of proof of something, will still go, no, that's an exception. I know this thing I believe is like that. We as humans need to believe something, and once we believe that thing, that's it.
Okay, so my take on that is, these are not humans who are doing it. These are human adults.
Yes,
you don't have kids behaving this way
mm-hmm.
unless there's an adult forcing it upon them.
Right.
So what that tells me is there is a failure in our educational system that does not train people how to think about data,
mm-hmm.
how to process information. We just hand you information. Here's the book. Learn it. You're testing on it tomorrow. And we're left with the impression that knowledge and information is a regurgitatable thing that doesn't require any kind of creative thought
mm-hmm.
whatsoever.
Right.
But it couldn't be farthest from the truth. If you were taught that science, how science, what science is and how and why it works, rather than here's the facts, give it back to me at the exam, I think you would inoculate students from behaving that way as adults.
Sure.
And then that study would have found nothing.
Right.
Had we trained people the right way in the first place. And so that's why I'm tired of hitting adults over the head. I just go back to the educational pipeline. And I wrote something on this. You can Google it on the internet. It's just called What Science Is and How and Why It Works. It's not that long, but it tells you what it means to know something and to establish an objective truth.
And to have an emotional connection to it, too. I think that's really this idea.
That's what makes it hard.
What you're saying is, yeah, how do you find an emotional connection to something? Because the facts are so dry and they can be – I mean, you can tell someone A squared plus B squared equals C squared. Why do they need to know that? Why do they, it's like, especially if they're texting in their other hand, or they're not, or they're thinking about what they're going to do later. I almost kind of feel like that type of education should have to happen again when you're an adult, because
a booster shot of education.
Yeah, because when you're a kid,
your
hormones are raging. You're thinking about too many other things. You're thinking about where do I fit in, and you're trying to establish your identity, your ego. You don't know, mm-hmm. and so it's just hard to have room for how do I, why do I need to learn this stuff when there's so many other things out there?
Especially post middle school.
Right. So, I mean, I think I have so much greater of an appreciation now. And I was actually a pretty good student. But I have a, so much greater of appreciation now. Like even now I think, oh, I want to learn more languages, or I want to learn, I just want to learn more basics of physics, or
which, you know, so it, in that vein, another thing that the educational system fails to do is instead of teaching you what to know, yes, we should teach you what to know. That, yes. But in addition to teaching you what to know, they should instill a permanent sense of curiosity within us all. Because you'll spend many, many more years not in school than you spent in school. And if you stop learning the day you graduate, that's a problem for all of society. So if you stay curious through adulthood, maintaining that kind of childhood wonder, then what? Imagine the world that would be.
Well, it would be amazing. But I know it is no small feat for teachers, especially, you know, in education systems where, you know, funding is not what it should be. And so how does one person communicate to hundreds of people who have hundreds of different points of view and interests and perspectives, who, you know, a lot of them don't want to be there. Like, I don't, I have all the respect in the world for someone who every day can get up in front of people that they know, most of which don't want to be there, right, and try to impart information to them. So on top of that, how do you instill that curiosity?
Teachers,
yes. How do you then find an emotional way into hundreds of people when most of them are just stonewalling you?
So let's get back to that emotional point, because like in the study that you described, people, their attachment to an idea, the only way you can describe that is it being emotional, because if it was rational or dispassionate, they would discard one idea and adopt another in the face of evidence, but they don't. So maybe there's not enough emotion, or the emotion that does appear in the educational pipeline is not properly tuned to the content. So they allow you to bring all your own emotions, and then you cherry pick what you want to be true. And then you go off in life with a warped sense of what is and is not going on in the
but
universe.
But is that what our brains are capable of? Because I wonder sometimes if technology has evolved faster than our brains can actually handle it.
No one under 30 would ever say that. So that's an old fart comment. You realize this.
I do, but okay? But when
old folks, you know, this internet is happening so fast.
But I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because there's so much information that people are asked to process all day, every day. And they just don't really take the time to research anything.
I ask my kids, and they are not fazed by this at all. I have a 15-year-old and now a 20-year-old. This is a non-issue, just a non-issue. Just hang up your old fogey concerns and just get with the program.
I'm not talking about for me. I'm talking about how people – because I think it'd be really interesting to really like – what people talk about and what people staunchly believe, and go, well, I saw this article. And I go, well, did you really read it? No, but I saw the headline. How, if you really peeled back the layers, do people really believe what they think they believe? How much research have they done? Can they actually do research? Because
no, they can't. But so the you know, there's the famous quote. There's nothing so painful. Paraphrasing it, there's nothing so painful to the human mind than the prospect of a new idea.
right.
Yeah. So we have to we need to train ourselves to embrace new ideas and new thoughts. And I can tell you this: I think the religion business has perfectly attached emotions to ideas.
Sure.
Which is why you can have people blowing themselves up in the name of an idea.
Right.
And you can't blow yourself up in the absence of emotion. There's got to be some deeply felt feelings in that act. So I think the rest of these branches of civilization do not have the emotion business linked with its content in the way the religion business does.
It's kind of interesting sometimes to think that, and I think in some cases, certainly not all, but in some cases, science can become a religion and religion can become very scientific, like a science in the sense of knowing how, you know, religion being able to sort of predict how people are going to react in a certain way.
It's psychology.
Psychology. And then with science, I feel like sometimes, and it's kind of what I was poking at earlier.
Wait. By the way, in all fairness to that comparison, there are many people who do receive deep and lasting advice, social, personal advice from their preacher, from their rabbi. These tend to be wise people relative to the average person in the public. So So though we don't call them psychologists, they can serve that same role in a community.
And absolutely.
Do. Yeah.
And should. And that's mm-hmm. really that's
as it has been. Right.
What has been. But I'm also, you know, it's sort of what I was poking at earlier was, you know, do you come up in science at all against people that just that do the same thing, that like really smart people that you go, well, you should be smarter than what you're doing right now, but you're not open to any new ideas, or you think you know everything because you know have a wall full of degrees. Like how do you break through to those people, and how do you challenge yourself not fall into that?
I would say they're not smart. you have a flawed definition of smart.
Okay.
If smart equals how many degrees you have on the wall.
Okay.
Right. And for me, I've been, you know, I'm just jumping on you about that
because
I've been trying to redefine smart.
Please.
Because the smart person is always the one in the class that got the high grades. We are, dare I say, brainwashed into equating the high grades with the smart person.
Mm-hmm.
Now go have a conversation with the founder of Twitter, of Facebook, of Microsoft, of all of these great things that have shaped our lives, and ask them, did they get the highest grades in class?
No.
The answer is no. 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 Would anyone call them smart by these metrics? No. No. So what's going on here? Is the valedictorian always the person that makes the difference in the world, or is that just the person who studied the hardest? Should we use the word smart to apply to such people?
Or should we be saying, you're a good regurgitator?
You're the best regurgitator there ever was.
I mean, how do you test comprehension? How do you
test the curiosity that should remain after you've learned something? How do you test your ability to come up with a new idea in the face of previous ideas?
Right.
And that is not regurgitory.
Right.
Well, that's like a place you go to after you die.
That's right. That's the place you go to regurgitory. Where the universe just spits you out into another form because energy can't be destroyed.
Right. So maybe we need to rethink what it means to be smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to link smart to creativity. And then that brings in artists. You hardly ever hear the word smart applied to artists. They say, oh, they're creative, they're innovative.
You can't smell smart without art. And that's not fair.
So I think smart needs to be broadened in that regard. And so once you've done that, then you are filtering for those people, and the current educational system doesn't do this. If you broaden what smart is, then you're filtering in the educational system for people who will actually transform tomorrow's civilization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
those are the smart people.
Well, with art, there's definitely an emotional acuity that a really good artist will have.
I like the emotional acuity.
An emotional acuity.
That's
yeah.
Beautiful.
Oh, thanks. they are able to see something and re-express it into an idea.
Express it with enough to bring you along, but enough new stuff for you to say, hey, I've never even thought about it.
So that actually defines exactly what it was that you said in the beginning, is you are helping to illuminate the art in science, which I think is a pretty interesting idea.
Okay, I'll take that. To me, the art is a capital A. It's any creative ways that people express their energies. And the extent to which science informs that, we're all over it.
Yeah.
At all times.
What is your number? What is your big thing? Do you have a different thing every year that you feel like, well, this is the thing that I'm kind of obsessed with this year of trying to figure out, or this is the thing?
Yeah, no, I don't use the time it takes Earth to go around the sun to divide up periods of time that interest me. This year I'm going to, no, maybe it's 6 months,
yep.
Maybe it's 2 years. But no, there are projects that excite me and keep me interested. It's usually through the books that I'm writing,
because mm-hmm.
books take a lot of effort and a lot of research.
Yes.
And so there's the Star Trek book that like just came out yesterday.
I have it right here.
The time of
this amazing Star Talk tie that has planets on it.
So they're trying to buy your allegiance by giving you a free Star Talk tie?
Yeah, it works. Yeah, I'm that easily.
So now you only say nice things about...
I would only say nice things anyway, but now I have a tie, so now I can say nice things while wearing my Star Talk
tie. So I'll be watching you on At Midnight to see if you wear the tie.
I'm totally going to wear the Star Talk tie.
No, I don't know. I'm going to be looking.
I swear to you I will wear the Star Talk tie on At Midnight.
Now that you're at 11:30 or whatever.
Now that we're at 11:30, yeah, we're at 11:30, which may be temporary. We honestly don't know. We don't know.
Uh-huh.
But
you weren't at midnight in the mountain zone anyway, right?
No, we were at 11 o'clock. And
I think they're just so accustomed to no someone giving a rat's ass what time it is in the mountains? That they have to do their own math. They must be really good at time zone calculations because I suck at it. Wait, is LA ahead of us or behind us? Or
what's happening? Are we recognizing daylight? We're not recognizing.
Right. And is the TV, is that the time it's in my time zone? I think the mountain time zone are the best time zone correctors there ever were.
It really makes you think. The mountain time zone really, and you always have to go, except for mountain, we get it, mountain time zone, we understand. But yeah.
I don't think they fess up to why they don't get care. But, you know, there are more people that live within 20 miles of my apartment in Manhattan than populate the entire mountain time zone.
Yeah.
So I think the programmers, you know, they just don't care.
They just don't think about it as
much.
Yeah. But they're important. We're sticking up for you, mountain time zone. This is your time is near. There's going to be an uprising, and it's going to just like the mountains, like with the plates coming together, they're going to
rise up. Well, the fun part is,
up.
If you get a New Yorker in the mountain time zone, the first reaction is typically, I'd have a great view if the mountains weren't in the way. They're blocking how far I can see.
Oh, you normally look at our buildings. Now you
exactly.
can see a mountain. What a great...
Why? Surely there's a building on the other side that I can watch.
They're really, you know, I really love looking at mountains for like 20 minutes.
Okay.
And then I'm like, okay, now I got to go do something else.
Well, but so here my concern is, as a city person who likes cityscapes, that mountains are great in the daytime, but in a moonless night, the mountains disappear entirely.
They do.
Right. And so they don't contribute to your visual anything after twilight.
That's why we need to put like really
you need
cool
lights on the
Tron circuitry.
No, you have to. you carpet the side of the mountain with houses.
Yes.
And have them all turn on their street lights.
Or.
Then you'd have a cool.
How about
side.
This? Bioluminescent grass. Right? That just like coats the mountain so at night they just glow.
They just have a little. Or a key light, you know, on
yeah,
the side. Yeah.
Just something. Something I know.
Which is what the moon does, actually. The full moon at night does give you, especially snow capped mountains.
It's pretty good at that.
It's
pretty good at reflecting the sun down back on it. Well, we were just in Japan where it was gorgeous.
My daughter was in Japan for 3 months.
Oh, really?
Summer. Yeah,
I'm
she's
so
loving,
jealous.
That's loving Japanese language and cultures.
It is a great. Yeah. I love the language.
Yeah.
I love the language because it makes so much. I mean, there's a lot to learn.
Did you know? I didn't learn. I freaked out. My daughter told me. Did you know that they have a different counting system for flat things as they do for cylinders?
What? That's like the first time your teacher's like, now let's talk about non-Euclidean geometry. Like, that's a thing?
That's a thing. So there's a different words, different phrasings when they count like sheets of paper than if they counted cans on a shelf than if they counted people.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it's – well,
it just got hard.
Nicely precise, right?
It is very nicely precise. It does, it does make sense. It is very logical and it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I really do love the language.
Mm-hmm.
But of course – you know, when you start getting cocky and then you're like, kore wa nan desu ka? And then they start talk. You've asked them, what is this thing? Naturally, they're going to answer you in Japanese. Why did I do that?
No, you have to say it with more of a gringo accent so
right.
that they're more forgiving of.
Kore wa nan desu ka? Mr. Japanese man.
I didn't mean Texan accent.
Oh, okay, sorry. That's just where my brain goes. I apologize. Hey, what is it? Was that a better one? Oh, hey, come on. Have you spent time in Japan?
I was on a government trip there. That's all I can
tell.
No, sorry.
That's all.
No, I was on a commission. I was on a White House commission to study the world climate, not weather climate, just the world business climate for the future of aerospace, the aerospace industry.
How does that happen? Does your phone ring and you're like, hello? And it's like, Neil, it's
kind of exactly
Barry
that.
Obama. Yeah. Do you want to go do
a
thing?
It is kind of a little bit like that. I recently got a phone call from the Secretary of Defense for me to join a new board that they're setting up, the Defense Innovation Board. So I'm a member of that. So it's like the guy who's carries the football around to the president, you know? So, so it's a phone call. It's what it is.
And
they don't direct message me on Twitter or anything.
You up?
Yeah, you up? Yeah, I got to see you tomorrow in Washington.
Hey, want to be on this defense council?
At the Pentagon, yeah. Meet you in E-ring.
It's like a government booty call. It's like, hey, you up? Want to go to Japan? All right. Tell us about
booty call.
Tell us about defense.
No, but you got to do it because it's a call, a literal call of duty. And, you know, we're all in this country together. And to the extent that I can offer insights or advice or perspective, I'm honored and privileged to serve that. So,
how do you think Dr. Sagan would feel about, would he be happy with what's going on now? Or would he be like, we've taken a giant step back or we've made some advancements?
I don't know. He was had very strong socially progressive views at a time when we were still in the Cold War and there's the worried about mutual where everybody fires all the weapons and you'd get what did he call it,
what happens in war games, basically.
Nuclear winter, which was the whole fear in the 1980s, because if at the time there was total nuclear exchange, you would burn up all the forest, put soot in the air, block the sunlight, plunging all of Earth into an incessant winter, knocking out the base of the food chain, and then killing all life on Earth that eats plant life that would have needed the sunlight. By the way, while that's unthinkable today because we're not at war in that kind of war with the Soviet Union, that the same computer calculations that arrived at those conclusions are what were used to learn about asteroid strikes.
Oh, boy.
And what role an asteroid might play in the extinction of our species. It's not just a crater and you died where it happened to hit.
Right.
You can actually affect the climate of the entire Earth. And around the same time was when we came to understand that the 65 million years ago, they went extinct by way of an asteroid.
And that would cause cataclysmic seismic activity
dust in the air, and it would kill you on the antipodal side of the Earth, even if you were nowhere near the explosion. And so then people started looking for a crater from 65 million years ago, and we found it. And it's off the tip of the Yucatan Peninsula. And it's a 100-some-odd mile diameter crater, and you date it right from when the dinosaurs went extinct.
I mean, we throw the figures around and you go, hundreds of millions of years, hundreds of millions of years is a ridiculous time in our history.
Okay, you ready for this? All right, so watch.
And not our history, in the history of the planet.
Right. So watch, you ready? So the dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago, mm-hmm. and there were a whole set of books trying to understand their extinction. Well, they had little walnut-sized brains. They weren't smart enough to survive anything. Excuse me. They were around for hundreds of millions of years before they went extinct. Right. So here's the number. You ready? They were around for longer than the time that has elapsed since they went extinct.
Oh, my gosh.
So if the asteroid...
By a lot.
So if the asteroid never hit, there is no reason to think that they would be extinct today.
Right.
At all. And our mammal ancestors would still be running underfoot, trying to not be hors d'oeuvres for T-Rex.
And they would have evolved into a Super Mario style.
Maybe.
Walking and talking
Their video games would have had humans in
it. They would have had humans in them. a lizard plumber would be stomping on an Italian guy.
And their movies would have humans attacking Tokyo, right? It would be whatever.
a naked ape coming out of the sea, and then all these little lizard people are going to have to... Yeah.
You know, so it's...
That's fantastic.
So just let's be sort of clear about the contingencies of the Tree of Life.
Yeah.
And we don't know if the dinosaurs would have evolved a big brain. They didn't in the 200 million years they were on Earth. They didn't need to.
Right.
Big teeth make a great substitute for intelligence.
I feel like that's how the internet operates.
It's like, we're there next to the T-Rex. Let's see how I can outsmart the T-Rex. And a half a second later, he's bitten you in half,
okay, I see you're upset. Maybe you want to talk this through, and I'm dead.
A lot of good your brains did.
But it really does. It does. It freaks me out sometimes when I think about it. It's like, okay, we have like 10,000 years of
nothing.
Of modern humans.
Nothing.
And it's just it's a speck of nothing in the wind. I mean, it really sucks.
And I got to think about this recently. I don't know if you knew, I have a cameo in Ice Age 5.
Oh, nice.
Yes. What, did you even know that there were 5 movies?
I always see the posters. Like, yeah, they're very...
Is it the same movie? No, it's yet another movie. And I didn't know they had almost as many as Fast and Furious.
Mm-hmm.
But they're,
yeah,
so I have a cameo, and I help them solve a problem. It's Ice Age: Collision Course, where they discover from legends and other sources that there's an asteroid that's going to come render them extinct. And they have to figure out a clever way to deflect the asteroids, the asteroid. And I help make this happen.
But they don't.
Well, no. So they do deflect the asteroids. They just all go extinct for other reasons. So
bad real estate deals.
100% extinct Ice Age mammals.
Mm-hmm.
All of them. The giant sloth.
Yeah.
The master. The mammoth. They're all extinct.
There's this like dinosaur grade cocaine. They're all rendered impotent.
Saber toothed tiger. They're all in the tar pit. They're all in the tar pit. Go find the whole cast and characters of Ice Age in the La Brea pit.
I mean, that is so. I mean, it really. I really do understand. I mean, you know, like you, I'm not a religious person, but I don't begrudge anyone their religion. I feel like whatever, I really do believe, like, whatever you feel like you need, as long as you're not infringing on other people,
mm-hmm.
great. But. I'm kind of jealous of it sometimes because I think, I mean, legitimately as a species, most of what we do is really futile because there is going to be an endpoint at some point. I mean, like unless we can race to get to another planet at some time and colonize the species that we have. But the idea like, oh, there's no, after this, there's more stuff like that. I'm so jealous of that, that idea.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah. So you want an idea that'll keep you going in death.
Well, just so you know. Yeah. Just so you know, because, you know.
No, so the better idea is reincarnation.
Yeah, but I don't either. Like
as a better human.
You know, I almost like the idea of like, okay, well, maybe there's some sort of like mitochondrial DNA thing. And maybe, you know, through like on a molecular level through carbon. Yes. But, you know,
except not, because if it were, perhaps, you would have some, well, this is what reincarnated people would say about themselves, although it doesn't really hold up under laboratory scrutiny. But after death, why should you think your awareness or your consciousness would be any different from what you were before you were born?
Yeah, that's exactly how
it's the state of non-existence.
It's the state of non-existence or not. It's just an unawareness, and I think that's why that part doesn't.
So what we do, so the way we solve that is instead of wondering what happens after death, we just alter our genome so that you never die.
That would be fun.
Then it's a non-question.
Then it's a non-question.
What happens after I die? Die? What?
Nothing.
What are you talking about?
I don't know. What do you mean?
What do you mean?
We solved that.
Yeah, we got that solved long ago.
Why is it always people?
Well, by the way, if you're going to not die, you better start colonizing planets.
You have to.
You're going to run out of space for the next generations, who I presume you're going to still make babies.
Well, hopefully you don't run out of atmosphere before.
Right. No, you need to be able to move to other planets. And personally, I don't mind an expiration date on my genome.
You don't mind?
No, because it gives me focus in my life.
It makes you kind of make all
the
stuff
I wake
count.
Up in the morning and say, what am I going to do today? Because I can count the number of days I'll be alive.
Boy, psychologically, what would that do to you if you had eternity?
It'll completely fuck with your priorities.
You wouldn't care about anything because it wouldn't
have to.
There would never be any urgency to do anything.
That's right. And procrastination would just be... I'll procrastinate tomorrow.
I'm going to sleep now. I'm going to procrastinate. Why is it always people?
Are you procrastinating if you procrastinate later?
I almost kind of think...
That's almost no.
We don't have the psychology to really exist forever because we couldn't...
Well, you know what it would be? It would be like you would never cross the street. Because you might get hit by something, and that would end your life when you could have lived another billion years.
Oh, I see. So
your whole risk calculation is different.
We're not immortal. We're not invulnerable.
Right.
We just could theoretically live.
Forever. Correct.
Right.
So then I wonder if you're like a billion years old. Are you just completely scarred by all the pans that you took out of the oven? If that happens once every century, but you live a billion years, you're going to have totally burnt, scarred skin.
You're going to look like Freddy Krueger. Or it's going to be like Death Becomes Her, where they just all deteriorate.
Oh, yeah, right. I remember I saw that.
Oh, it's so good. Robert Zemeckis movie.
I saw that.
Great. That's
the one where they use spray paint.
It's Bruce Willis and Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep. Fantastic comedy.
Yeah, Bruce Willis is the Undertaker. Yeah.
But that is a really interesting idea of what it would take for us psychologically to deal with that and what we'd have to do to maintain ourselves.
And we touch a little bit of that in the StarTalk universe. There's a whole section in the book. What is it to be human and what is the future of what we are?
Right.
And once you can control the genome, if there's a planet that's not quite just like Earth, just fix your genome so that you can thrive there.
Yeah.
And you don't have to wait around for evolution to kill off all the variations that don't.
Yeah, once you master evolution, once you master your own genome, it doesn't really...
Yeah, and in fact, you can look at the entire offerings of the tree of life. And since we all have DNA in common, just steal it.
Yeah.
Right? So for me, what would be first on my... You know, there are people say who are complaining about fish genes in tomatoes.
Right.
I don't want GMOs. I don't want fish in my tomato. Well, it prevents it from freezing because there's a gene that enables that. I don't see what your freaking problem is.
Right.
But, okay, it's a reminder that all life on Earth has some fraction of common DNA. This is evidence of this, that you can even do that in the first place. So would you object if I went to a newt, took out its regeneration gene, put it in a veteran who had his legs blown off fighting our wars, and it regrows their limbs in just the way it works with a newt?
Well, no, of course no one.
Are you
going
to tell me no,
that.
Don't do that because you're combining species?
Right.
No, you're going to say this is really cool. We can do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I see things like that. If a newt can grow legs, let's put that feature in humans. If some other creature is radiation resistant, let's find out what genes that is and put that in. We can make a human that is the superset in principle, the superset of all the coolest stuff that's out there in the life forms that we've come to study.
But it's interesting that that's never portrayed as a good idea in film. It's always portrayed as like, you know, there's some, you know.
Wait. By the way, we've been changing ourselves from the beginning. Why do you go to the gym if not to just get bigger muscles?
Right.
Or to trim fat so you look different
right.
from what you would otherwise look like?
Right.
Why do you color your hair? Why do you straighten your hair if it's curly? Or curl your hair if it's
or
straight?
Or eat certain foods or don't eat certain
foods.
This food
and not that food.
Right.
Everything we do is to reshape our experience. Why are you getting mammary reduction surgery or increased surgery? Why are you getting the nose
job? I did it
job?
Because I was embarrassed of my huge tits.
Okay. Think of what we are already doing to change ourselves. You're going to say now we can do it genomically? You say no, we are violating God's will or whatever. What? So I think if you step back and look at what it's like, the people who say I don't think we should clone humans because we might harvest their organs because there's all right, and I'm saying all right, we already have clones in society. They're called twins. Okay. So we've already done the experiment. Are we harvesting the organs of twins to feed? No, we're not doing that.
It's the same guy. It's the same people who are like, you know, I don't think I'm going to go to the gym because I don't want to get all ripped. And it's like, do you know what you would have to do in order to get to that point?
To get as ripped as you think you're not doing.
Yeah, you don't go to the gym two times. People are like, whoa, take it down a notch. By the way, I always love seeing your wrestling picture come up. I'm serious. That is a great...
I don't know how it got out there because it was like a printed... It's like an old... It's from a film. It's like plus X film printed in a dark
man.
Room. But no, that's in the day. And I had a little bigger afro then. It was in style, just so you know.
It had to be in the 70s,
right?
It was
right? in the 70s. 1970, yeah. Yeah, 78.
It looks...
Yeah.
You know what? Honestly, though, it looks good today, though. Like, it looks cool and retro. And
oh, okay.
I'm
well,
telling
thank
you.
Thank you. That was 45 pounds ago, just to be clear. Okay. I can measure time by poundage.
So you were studying science and you were wrestling.
Oh, yeah. I was majoring in physics at Harvard, but knowing all along that my soul was in the depths of the universe, and so all my extra classes were taken in astrophysics, ready to go on to graduate school in astrophysics. But yeah, I wrestled just because it was a fun place to dump excess energy.
Yeah, well, and also just having a more rounded. Approach to life and not just being stuck in a cul-de-sac of like, this is the only thing I know and care
about.
Yeah,
you know, I don't want to judge people who are cul-de-sac'd.
Right.
I don't know that I'd be a better or worse scientist if I did or didn't wrestle, but I do like the feeling of being in shape and strong and wrestling, you get that. I mean, that's because that's what you do. You're kicking somebody's ass.
All right, I'm gonna pitch you an idea.
What's that?
Friday night midnight wrestling matches at Hayden Planetarium.
It's the dome.
Having scientists wrestle at the planetarium.
I would need a cage name like Orion's Revenge,
yes.
You know, something. And then you get Hercules. You get like constellation names.
Yes.
Yeah, that could happen.
Killer of Pluto. There you get the shit for that for the rest of your life.
But okay, if the attendance gets really bad, maybe I'll give you a call on that.
I'm telling you,
even just once as a charity event, it might be really fun. Even one time as a charity event. You're not, it's a good idea. I think it's a fun idea.
Yeah, the audience is looking skeptical.
I know. I want to talk about like pulling people emotionally into science through something pop culture-y or something different and something fun. I mean, I honestly.
See, you know what I do? Instead of turning pop culture into the science thing, I let you keep your pop culture and then tell you the science that fits to it. It's a slightly different direction of the vector.
We do that. I just saw that. I think Wired actually did a thing on what Luke Cage's mass would have to be, and there was like torque, you know, to explain how, you know, his skin would be hard enough to stop a bullet, and how he could pick someone up standing still ground and all that stuff. It is.
That's what you do, and you apply. So a good friend, a friend of mine, a colleague, a physicist at the University of Minnesota, his name is James Kakalios. He wrote a book called The Physics of Superheroes. Oh my gosh! You learn that I didn't know Flash has atmospheric separators in front of him so he doesn't burn up. You know, little things like that. You gotta like consider this.
The friction would kill him.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
The air friction
rip him apart.
That.
So they got to solve that, and there are ways to think about. And I had the privilege of contributing to comic book lore by showing Superman where his home star was. Did you know about this?
No.
You didn't know about this?
I didn't know about this.
I thought you knew. You were the Nerdist.
Yeah, I guess I'm not anymore.
Oh my gosh.
What happened? You know, where did this
interview's over.
What? Neil.
Come back.
He didn't leave. He's just hitting his hands on the table, but I think that means he's done. Oh. Sorry. Here.
Here comes the door. Yeah, slam the door. All right, so I got...
Neil, where did you come from? You just left.
I got called by DC Comics.
Yep.
Again, it's the booty call, right? Yep. Or the DC Comics call. Said, we're writing an episode for Superman, for the comic, and we want him to visit the Hayden Planetarium. Will you give permission for us to draw it? Duh, of course. What am I going to say? No to that?
Right.
And then I said, well, what's up? They would say, we want him to go there to see the destruction of his home planet.
Oh, because he's going to look at it through the...
So we're going to have some instruments that will enable this.
It's going to measure the explosion.
And I said, okay, but that means he got here ahead of the light beam.
Oh.
So I said, all right, so I had to work this through with them because I don't think they thought it through. So I said, we all know he was launched Moses style, and he landed on Earth no older than when he left. He's a baby.
Right.
So if the baby's 6 months older, you would know it. All right? 6 months on a baby is clear. So basically, it didn't age. So either he came to Earth at the speed of light, and when you're traveling at the speed of light, time stops for you.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's the case, he's with the crest of light that shows the destruction of his home planet.
Right. So he'd have to travel faster than the speed of light.
Exactly. So I said the only way to get here ahead of it is to, and still be a baby, is to come via a wormhole.
Okay.
And they're aliens, so they can figure that out.
Right.
So good. So they said, okay, bet. We've got that. All right. So now he gets here in a wormhole. Then I said, how old is he? And they said, he's eternally in his late 20s. So I said, all right, let me find a star that is like 25, 26, 27, 28 light years away.
Mm-hmm.
That gives him a chance to age to that point, then see the light finally reach Earth.
Oh, wow.
So then I said, you know, I can find you a star. I've got the catalog. There's a zillion stars out there. I spent a day, found a star in the southern hemisphere, a red star. 20, because Krypton was red.
Yes.
27 light years away. I said, here's your star.
Well, the sun was red. Yes, Krypton.
Sun. I forget. Krypton is the planet or the star. But in either case, yeah, their host star is red. So I found a red star. And I gave him two red stars and said, we want this one, not the other. I said, why? I said, because this other one is in the constellation Corvus. I told them what constellation. And I said, well, why do you care? Corvus the Crow. The Crow is the mascot for Smallville High.
Oh.
Yes!
Oh!
So we nailed this. Oh, my gosh. And so after they're excited, I'm excited. And they said, do you mind if we portray you meeting Superman at the planetarium? And I said, look, after all Superman's done for Metropolis, the least I could do is help the guy out.
Yeah.
And so then we figured out a plausible way where we can image his planet because you need like interferometers as wide as Earth. So there's some language in there that smells like real astrophysics.
Yeah.
And then we finally put the image on the dome.
That's amazing.
And then he looks sad because while he knew intellectually he lost his home planet, at last, and sadly, he now felt it emotionally.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So
that's Action Comics 14.
You
it's
found
out there.
Krypton. Now all you need to do is locate Metropolis on a map.
Apparently, it's across the bay from Gotham City.
That's all
we would learn.
That's all we have to learn. Yeah. So he just came over to New York. Which is where was the Hayden Planetarium in Metropolis or was the Hayden Planetarium in New York?
Well, so see, for me, I put it in New York because the Daily Planet is, of course, the Daily News.
Right.
And the Daily News building has the rotating planet in its lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these icons from the TV show and all the rest of this, it all feels like New York to me.
Yeah.
And so I'm giving it to me, Superman's in New York.
So what is when you are working on the television show, what does your day look like when you are still actually a scientist?
Yeah, so it's
and
tough.
You have to make a TV
it's
show.
It's tough. I'm ready to like get all this out of my system and then just go back to the lab and just cede the whole thing to everybody else. Because I'm a servant of public appetite, but I can tell you this, if it's only happening because of me, then that's like cult building. And I want to see a huge I want to see a whole community of people coming up who can do exactly what I'm doing. And we're trying to cultivate that with Star Talk.
Yeah.
We've had great expert guests who were scientists who were brought on to comment on the main interviews with the celebrities.
Yeah.
And they were so good and had such good telepresence that – and we kept in touch with them. We created another cadre of hosts, and we call them the Star Talk All-Stars.
Nice.
And they now have radio shows, and it's part of the Star Talk umbrella.
That's good.
So I think that's great. That's right. And they have guests, and they talk about science and pop culture and geeky things. And so I feel good about where that has gone. And that way, one day, I'll just kind of tiptoe away, and no one will know I'm missing.
Well, people would know you're missing. But, you know, the other reason it's good is because it just, you know, they have perspectives, and they have things that they're excited about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they want to sort of bring that to the public. And if you have a scientist who wants to do that, you want to totally exploit that fact.
I did the exact same thing at Nerdist. It was just me in the beginning, and at a certain point I was like, well, but other people like different things, and maybe other people should come in and talk about what they like,
because
I have a limited point of view, so why not?
Right.
So what are you working on now? You said a couple things that you were excited about.
Well, so there's like 5% of my life, not much more, maybe 10%. I'm trying to stay current with my sort of research frontier. I've always liked the structure of the galaxy, the birth, life, and death of stars, and large-scale structure of the universe. These are my professional research interests.
Mm-hmm.
So, by the way, I was sort of branded with like demoting Pluto, but my professional interests were never the planets. This is just an intelligent read of what my planetary colleagues were discovering. That's all that was. And I was in a position to make an exhibit that was the first public exhibit to rethink Pluto's role in our lives. So then I got branded as that. But no, my research interests have always been stars and galaxies. The day is full. There's doing Star Talk. There's I'm writing. So I have a book coming out later in the year and another one this spring. The one in the spring? Can I tell you about this one? Oh, can I come back for the one in the spring?
You can come back whenever you want.
Okay, the one in the spring, I don't know if I should mention it yet.
Oh, mention
it. No, I wouldn't be surprised.
Just give us a, you know, like wet the appetite of the people so they kind of know in what region.
All right. Well, so this fall, the book that's coming out is I co-taught a class at Princeton University when I was on the faculty there, and that class we turned into a book. And so it's for people who are ready for more.
Okay.
Right? None of this, let's just quickly turn the pages and give me a mile wide, an inch deep. This is a mile wide and 10 miles deep. So you learn about
– All right.
For example, you learn about the Goldilocks zone around a star where you're looking for exoplanets.
Right.
But then you calculate how you get the Goldilocks zone.
Oh, so it's
so
just,
there.
It goes in depth. It goes little more in
so
depth.
So it's the same fun science, but now let's see how we know this is true.
Right.
Right. So
it's the comprehension and the understanding and not just the regurgitation.
All of that. So that one is it's later in the fall, you'll see a media push on that.
Nice.
And it's called Welcome to the Universe, an astrophysical tour. And we don't pull any punches on that. So it's for people who are ready for more, or if you know someone who is an aspiring scientist, and you'll give them a book where they can learn whatever they can. They come back to it every 6 months, and more of that book will give them the power of understanding and the power to calculate.
Fantastic. And then spring, spring,
I come back. All right, I'll tell you the title. This is the first time I've ever mentioned
Please, yes, of course.
I don't even want to mention it.
Breaking news.
But you're my man, and I will tell you.
I appreciate it.
So in the spring, in May, there's a very tiny book I've written. Tiny book. It's called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. So it's the opposite of the other book.
You've read Welcome to the Universe, but okay. Maybe now you're out of time.
You ran out of time, or you were intimidated by the one, and you're stuck at the bus stop, but you're still in a hurry. This book is for you. And it's short and it's clean, and you'll end up fluent in everything you need to read headlines of all the stories that'll come.
And understand what it is.
That people
are saying.
So that's that.
Congratulations. That's great. The idea of writing a book is such a...
So I love writing because then I'd rather just stay home. All this interview stuff.
I know, running around the planet.
I'll stay home in my pajamas, yes. Right? And go to the refrigerator.
It still works. You're still imparting knowledge, and it's still reaching people.
But then it's less. I like the creativity of writing and composing the perfect sentence.
Yeah.
Or aspiring to write the perfect sentence, untouchable by editors,
yes.
And the sentence rises above the page, and the reader can only absorb it into their mind, body, and soul. That's what I strive for.
In a hurry.
In a hurry.
I'm actually bidding on an auction that ends today that I think you would love. It's the most remarkable.
Attending auctions is the sin of making too much money, just so you know, okay?
Can I tell you what's in this auction?
What's in the auction?
It's called the Remarkable Rarities Auction. There are unpublished compositions by Beethoven in it.
Wow.
There are handwritten ideas written by Newton. There's a letter that Einstein wrote President Hoover thanking him for a commendation that he was given. I mean, and they have one of the robotic looking dummies with just a couple little actuators on the joints from NASA from the early space program. I mean, it is a museum.
Stuff that was otherwise behind the scenes.
Yes.
Or uncelebrated.
Yes.
So what are you going to bid on?
I'm really.
Or should you say that? Maybe because
no, I don't care. I'm interested in the Newton scrawling, and I'm interested in.
I'm a Newton guy, you know.
Well, I could show you.
I'm a Newton guy.
I will.
No, we can go in halves, and we'll just cut it in half.
just rip it. And then
me and Newton go way back.
I'll pull one side, and you pull another, and you go, see, every action is equal and opposite reaction. I get a bigger half because I'm taller than you are. But there's that, and I'm kind of interested in the letter, the Einstein letter, because it's he writes it. Oh, and then this guy wrote a book, he sent hundreds of famous people, not just like what we think of as celebrities, but like famous people, Mother Teresa, Charles Schultz, all these people. Do you believe
those two were the first two to come to your head?
To my head, yeah.
Mother Teresa and Charles Schultz.
Mother Teresa and Charles Schultz. Because they're highlighted in the auction.
Oh, fine.
But he posed as a child, and he wrote them letters in the, I guess maybe the 60s and 70s or the 80s, and he said, do you believe in God? Was just, do you believe in God? And it was just their responses. And Charles Schultz's is amazing because Charles Schultz just basically says, this is far too complicated an idea to express in a single letter. Thank you for your interest. Like, it's just this it's obvious that he doesn't want to tell the kid what he thinks because he thinks it's a kid.
Right.
But the auction.
By the way, if he did, he could have just said yes.
He could have just said yes.
So that all
said no.
So that's the long way to say no is really right. What that is.
But if you read a lot of the early Peanuts comics, they're very twisted and philosophical and very existential and, and like super mind bendy, but it's like this collection of 500 the actual responses all of those people.
Uh-huh.
There's letters from Washington. There are letters from presidents, Jackson. I mean, it is a remarkable collection of stuff.
So what's the Newton one?
The Newton one is. I can show it to you after.
Yeah, yeah. After,
thing.
After,
it's just a. Can you look up Remarkable Rarities Auction, and then just kind of rifle through the catalog a little bit until you find the Newton scrawling. I don't think it's. I think it's just like a strip of torn paper that was a large. You know, it's almost like a Rosetta Stone. So I don't
fragment.
Know how much. I don't know. If it's like a fragment.
It's a Newton fragment.
Yeah, it's a little Newton piece, but. But it's just the fact that it's his handwriting.
So is it? So does it say? So I have calculated the secret to the universe, and it is, and then it's ripped off at the bottom there. And then someone else finds another fragment, and the other fragment says 42.
42. It would have to say 42.
It would have to.
Yeah, it's going on today. Remarkable Rarities. Remarkable Rarities. Nope, it's going on today. It ends today. Yeah, I promise, because I'm signed up for it, and I've been bidding on it. There it is.
That's the fragment?
Isaac Newton handwritten manuscript fragment. There it is.
Okay. Whoa. How do I make the thing bigger here?
Yeah, let me. You can't really.
Oh, you zoom in on it. There you go. Okay. So, Henry, does it say what he says?
Yeah, it'll say right here in the text, right here. It should say. If you just
this is like his trash. This is out of his wastebasket.
I would take Newton's trash over anyone else's treasure. It says there's a frame. Let's see, handwritten manuscript fragment, unsigned, one page, no date, but circa 1700, an 8-line fragment plus 4 marginal citations from an apparently unpublished theological work by Newton. In part, martyrs, saith he to Vigilantius and Eunomius, the author of this heresy, frame a calumny against, I don't know that word, against ye church, and are not terrified with such society that you should speak the same things against us, which he doth against ye church. For all his followers enter not into ye churches of the apostles and martyrs. Eunomius feigned that these were juggling tricks of ye devils, and that ye devils did not truly cry out, but counterfeit their torments.
And you're bidding on this.
I might. No, this
actually, I assume you know that Isaac Newton penned more words on theology than he ever did on physics.
And it just the physics one stuck.
And alchemy. There were all these other topics. What was remarkable about Newton is basically there was a line in the sand between his writings. His physics writings are not completely infused with his theological musings, as was the case with some other scientists of the day.
Sure.
Because if they're one and the same and it is the nature of reality, why would you separate what your discoveries of physics from your discoveries of the Bible?
Right.
He did. Mm-hmm. They're basically completely different books, completely different avocations and activities. You read Newton's Principia, Newton's Calculus, Newton's Optics. There's like a couple of very rare mentions of God, and that's it. There's no other... God does not have a significant place within him. But other books, it's completely there. Completely there. So that looks like a little bit of those meanderings.
What do we know about him?
Emphasis on meanderings.
What do we know about him as a person? What do we know about
He was highly reclusive. By some measures, he was died a virgin.
Mm-hmm.
There was no friends anyone could identify that would correspond with a sexual partner, not even a homosexual partner, although the homosexual male community claims him as one of the early gay not early, they go way back, but
right.
But if you look at lists of famous homosexual men, he's often put on that list, but there's no evidence of him having a lover. Maybe he was psychologically, if not in practice.
Sure.
And apparently just not very social. So
a classic nerd. He was like the proto nerd. He was the proto nerd before nerds got all
the
social.
Patron saint of nerds.
He is essentially the patron saint of nerds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
Of course, you have to say nerd because you're the Nerdist, but geek is a perfectly legitimate word in this conversation.
Geek is a legitimate word. It's, you know, I feel like everyone's saying the same thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course,
geek,
of course. I think geek gained some currency when Best Buy started running around with the Geek Squad.
They ran around with the Geek Squad.
The currency value of that word jumped.
I mean, both words were derogatory in nature to begin with.
Yeah, but not anymore because now we can just... We have the power. Yeah. Geeks have resources. Geeks can reprogram your computer. We can hack into your...
And now can have conversations with people. It's like the T-1000s. We're the T-1000s. But that idea that... I'm interested to hear how much... how social these people were or how connected to reality they were. I mean, I think – I was just thinking about – I don't know why. I have no reason for what I
You can't say connected
to
reality with regard to Newton. The man was connected.
He was connected.
As connected
he was literally
as
connected to reality.
As he is connected as they come. Have you ever read Queries at the end of his work, The Optics?
No.
Okay. So these are crumbs left over that he didn't have time to experiment on.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just – here's one of them. Right? I wonder if the sun – and the stars are the same kinds of objects, except the sun is just much, much closer to Earth. I just want – it's just query number 12, you know, whatever.
Oh, well.
Every one of these is an entire brilliant research project, and he just never got around to them, but these are his thoughts, which is a reminder of how important it is that it may be more important to come up with the right question than even it is to come up with the right answer.
I mean, it just – the idea of working so hard to understand the nature of reality but not experiencing reality, you know? That's what is kind of interesting to me because I don't know why, but I've been thinking about
– Are you worried like going to the priest to get advice on your sex life?
Well, I did just get married, so I just lost my virginity.
Okay,
no,
all right.
No, I'm thinking – I was thinking of it in terms of like chess players or scientists. You know, like you know, I watched a documentary about Bobby Fischer and he went insane. You know, he completely lost his mind. And
by the way, just to be clear, it would not have been a documentary had he not lost his mind.
No, if he was totally fine.
Right. No one does
He would have had an Instagram account and everything would have been
people
fine.
People who are fine, there are no movies about them.
But just this idea that when you spend so much time absorbed in your own inner world as, you know, like grandmasters or scientists, like how do you not start warping a little bit when you're not kind of out experiencing life and connecting to the rest of the world?
What you're saying is you need continual you need reality checks.
Kind of.
Yeah, daily reality checks.
Because I think a lot of grandmasters get a little gooey in the head because they're just – if the entire time you're just thinking about science or just stuck in your head or not – you know, how do you become a citizen of humanity and still like have a life?
Right. So maybe having a life is what they're doing, not what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Fully exploiting all the neurosynaptic powers available to them.
Maybe.
And so so they look at you and pity. pity the rest – not you, but they pity the rest of us for not focusing our brain power as intently as they do. So you came into it from a biased perspective.
That's all I have the ability to do.
Most of us – there's a great line in Searching for Bobby Fischer, the movie.
Love that movie.
Yeah. That where the father, who's played by
Joe Mantegna,
goes into the school system who's saying he needs to stop playing this game and get serious about his work. He says to her – and I'll never forget it. He says, "My son is better at chess than you or I will ever be." But no, he's better at chess than you or I will ever be at anything we ever do.
Mm-hmm.
Or say I'm paraphrasing, but it's something else. Like, it's like, whoa. So if you are that, what does it mean for somebody else to say, "No, I need you to get more socialized. I need you to do this so that you
don't go
will
crazy.
Not be that.
Don't go. I think it's. I think it's good.
Plenty of grandmasters never went crazy. Just let the record show.
Name 50.
They're weird, but not crazy.
Well, the reason that I ask is because I get so focused on things sometimes that I feel like it cuts me off from the rest of the world.
Okay, getting married cures that. Because there's a limit to how long that focus. No, I'm serious. I'm being very serious.
I appreciate that as a comedy answer and as a real answer.
But no, but it's not how to make fun of marriages. It's focus is you are in your room, your place where all of your memory, wherever your thinking place is.
Yes.
And you do not come out even at the expense of personal hygiene.
Right.
And 18 hours later, you come out.
Mm-hmm.
That's not possible when you're sharing your place with another human being.
No, that's not.
That's all I'm saying.
What made me laugh is just that idea of, you know, of like working on something and then just having Lydia kind of poke her head and be like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm just focusing on a thing. I have a thing and I'm focusing on it. And I don't know why, but I need to figure it out.
Right.
And I can't step out of that." Are you able to – do you have to go into a mode when you're working on a project?
I do, but you can create those modes. So you can wake up before everyone else wakes up in the household.
Well,
and I got
idea.
Two kids and this sort of thing. Or you can stay up later than everyone else goes to sleep. There are pockets of time where you can create for yourself. I'm told that Toni Morrison, the
yeah,
brilliant Nobel Prize winning novelist, that she would check into a hotel when she was putting the finishing touches on her novel and just stay away from everybody. And then she would focus.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just – and what is time? Neil, what is time?
You're the guy who majored in philosophy. By the way, last time I was on your show when we had that fast exchange about philosophy,
yeah,
I made total enemies of half the world's philosophers from that one exchange where you said, I majored in philosophy. I said, oh, wow, did you get messed up or something?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you said, oh, no, I escaped. Or we had some.
Right.
People
took it personally.
It was a 20-second exchange.
And people took it personally, like we were attacking them or you were attacking them. How dare he? Oh, I remember that.
No, there was whole tracts. By professional philosophers saying Tyson needs to study philosophy before he expects. And I wrote back in the comment section, I said, are you actually this is a learned historical account of the importance of philosophy in the world as a rebuttal to that 20-second exchange. And I said, I this was a 20-second, a 30-second exchange with a comedian.
Right.
On a comedic podcast. And I'm flattered that that would earn this level. Then I sent them to links of other more nuanced commentary that I have about philosophy.
And those people would say, see, you're thinking too hard. You're trying to find answers where there's no answers. Because it was sometimes there are things are just surface level and they don't mean anything. But that's what a big shot you are, because whenever you say something, people like put it in a headline.
Well, and so one of the links I gave them was me on stage talking about philosophy with Richard Dawkins.
Right.
And which is a much more nuanced and a much more informed, if you want to react and write a diatribe, do it to that.
Right.
Not to me chewing fat with you. Right. And so.
Who has the time to research all that? Well, Neil, just want to be mad now.
So I noted that video had 750,000 views.
Uh huh.
So apparently, that whoever those viewers were didn't include these people. It didn't include the diatribe people.
Well, if they don't click on the link, they can't prove it exists.
Right. Are there? Oh. Oh, no, if it's in a forest, it does exist.
It does exist. Yeah, yeah. So, Star Talk is on Nat Geo. What is the airing information for Star Talk on Nat Geo?
Yeah, Mondays at 11. Check your local listings usually, but it's
and Mountain Time Zone. I don't know what you got. Mountain Time Zone is on 8:14 a.m.
Because in converting time zones, you got to carry the two.
Yeah.
You
know? And they have an eighth day of the week where they watch television.
And divide by seven. And
Now the people in the Mountain Time Zone are going to be like, God, it's going to be all the people that were mad. All those philosophers actually live in the Mountain Time Zone because they're reflecting, and now they're going to be mad because we're shitting.
They got to agree that they are way more time zone fluent than any of the rest of us because we are pandered to by the broadcast community.
Yes.
And they are not. So
yes.
They've got to fend for themselves.
We have all the respect in the world for the philosophers. I mean, comedy wouldn't exist without philosophy. You have to have philosophy to have comedy. Because of the deconstruction techniques and because of the questions that
the tools and tactics.
The tools and the tactics. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it all.
So,
all
so Monday nights, and the book is out. We're very proud of the book because the book could have been just a mess. Take all these hodgepodge and put it together. But we had brilliant designers and it's the amalgam of contributions from our writers, and I'm in there, and our comedians. Because they have clever quips about what's going on. So it's just a fun – I think – I would say this even if I didn't have anything to do with the project.
Oh.
It's just a fun read. You just open it to any page. Like let's do the experiment. Okay. Open any page and read some of the – just open a random page. Just do it now.
Now you're kind of doing the – this is almost the We Have a Badass Over Here meme.
I'd have had nothing to do with that meme. I still don't understand it. And I'll go to my grave wondering what the hell happened there.
Okay, I've just flipped open.
Okay,
here.
So what do you have there? What's the header?
The end is nigh, or is it?
Okay,
and
good.
Not Bill Nye, but Nye, N-I-G-H, Nye.
The end. So that's the end of the world. So that's that page. Go to another page.
Okay.
Okay. Random page. What's that one?
What makes music so seductive? And how do scientists study arousal in the lab?
There you go.
That's very sexy.
That's two random pages.
I have some thoughts on it, but I feel like...
you want to be a subject for that.
Human resources would not appreciate those. Everything you need to know about salt.
Salt, exactly. So these are questions you maybe didn't have, but say, hey, that's an interesting question. Or did have and never got the answer to.
NaCl. I know a couple
that
of
is,
things.
one kind of salt.
God damn it! I'm with the philosophers.
Wait, did you know? I tweeted this, and I thought people would react more than they did. So this is how I calibrate whether I'm saying anything relevant or not. That all table salt is sea salt.
Oh, man.
All of it.
So when you buy something that says specifically sea salt, like, yeah, good job. So is this other stuff.
Yeah, so is this other salt.
This other stuff doesn't have to showboat it.
So where do you get the other salt? It's mined
mm-hmm.
from long-buried seas that was once – long-buried bodies of water that were once seas.
But it wasn't when we got it. It was land salt we got it,
so
Neil.
So why do you think there's a deposit of salt – right down there, a mile down. Because there used to be a prehistoric sea that evaporated and left that salt deposit.
Maybe.
So your mine salt is sea salt. It's just much older. And I'm thinking they could have marketed that. This is Cambrian salt.
But then that just sounds like, hey, who wants some old salt? Like, that sounds gross. Where does creativity come from is another one. Chapter 4, what's real and what's virtual? Did a video game actually pass the Turing test?
Yeah, so these are all of this. These were topics that were actually discussed throughout the show, and I'm proud of how that came together.
Could Superman survive a black hole?
Mm.
Oh.
We talk about that, yeah.
Well, I guess it depends on the where it is and.
I'm not telling you. You have to buy the book and read it.
All right. Well, I have.
Actually, that's
book.
A free book. Why'd you give him a free book? He can get a buy.
Those are my tie. I'm going to carry it around while I wear my tie, and carry around the Star Talk Mondays. Oh, September 19th, new season September 19th.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which by the time this goes up was just a couple days ago.
And dude, I can plug you. Love at midnight. You know, if I can stay up that late because I'm an old fogey.
Thank you.
But now you're at 11:30, so that's helping a little.
That's helping a little bit.
Yeah, but it's fun to see just the flow of internet currency that goes through that program, and it's a great showcase for comedians.
Anything
to get comedians out there, I love.
Thank
it.
Thank you. I appreciate
that.
Yeah,
and how did you get the woman from the Verizon commercial?
Oh, Melania Vantrub.
How'd you get her?
She's a comedy person.
I didn't know that.
She's
great. She had great timing on
She's so funny.
Ads.
Yeah.
So it's not just she's a good actor. She's a good comedian.
She's a great comedian.
She gets it from
yeah.
being a comedian.
Yeah. She has like sketch comedy. I think she might have been in
didn't
an improv group.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
so I've always known that comedians can make good actors.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know actors don't always make good comedians.
But she actually,
it's not a two-way street.
She's actually, yeah, she's great.
Excellent.
But I've been really excited lately because.
And like last time I was in town, you had me come on just to show my face. I'm not witty like the comedians, but you had me, I read a clue or something. What was it?
You're very witty. And yes, you did. And you're welcome to do that anytime you want,
mm-hmm,
by the way.
Mm-hmm. No,
I mean,
it was fun.
When At Midnight first started, it was, you know, it was a little insipid in the sense of like, oh, we showed kind of cat videos and silly memes and stuff. And then the show really evolved. Actually, I think anyone, and I'm biased, but I think anyone would be hard pressed to find another show aside from like The Daily Show that talks about as much culturally relevant stuff as we cover. But I think the game show,
dude, I'm supposed to say that about you.
Oh yeah.
You're not supposed
yeah.
to say that about yourself.
I'm just saying what you should say. And then Katie's going to cut my part
okay.
out.
Yeah, no, it's, I guess the next closest thing that attempts that is Tosh.0. Cause he's deriving his content from the internet.
Yes.
And had just happened and brings people on and
comments on it.
But of course the shows are completely different. I'm just
yeah.
saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That it's, to give the internet its due in a whole other medium and talk about it.
Well, thank
it's
you
fun.
Very much. Well,
it's fun.
You are part of the universe and human culture and internet culture.
Because sometimes I wonder if I have a tweet that is particularly successful, I wonder if it ever catches your eye. Because just a few days ago, I tweeted about the future of the Earth, and people lost their minds on it. It was in 5 billion years, the sun will expand and engulf our orbit. And the charred remains of what was once Earth vaporizes. Have a nice day. That was the tweet. But it's now my second most retweeted tweet.
That's great.
It's got like 60,000 retweets. And people reacted to that. And almost playfully, of course, because it's fun, but it's true.
Right.
And I bet someone could write a psychology thesis on all the data we have on how people react to social media.
Well, I mean, that's something I think about all the time. I think as much as I love social media, and I don't think I would have a career without it, I feel like the long-term negative effects of social media are actually, I mean, listen, I guess from one point of view you could say they're going to be damaging, but another point of view you could say, well, no, people will just change. I really think it's created something in our culture where people just only know, because it's an emotional snapshot.
Yes.
Of whatever you're feeling, yep. like blah, and you may or may not feel that in 5 minutes,
But we've become conditioned to speak as superlatively as possible to get attention. So everything is the worst, dot, 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 or all caps, fuck you, because you piece of shit, you changed this one tiny thing.
Clickbait.
It's clickbait, and, you know, entertainment has... Okay.
Let me give you a sign of hope.
Yes.
A beacon of
Please.
Hope. Are you ready?
Great place to wrap.
Okay. It's a weak beacon, but a beacon nonetheless.
All right. It's a weaken.
All right. Do you remember when... did you study when the... printing press was invented.
Gutenberg.
Remember when? Approximately.
Approximately in the 1500s.
Yeah. Mid 1400s.
1400s.
Okay. All right. So now you can print things. So obviously people started printing books because we had books, and now you can print them and disseminate them widely. It would take 400 years for people to figure out that you can use a printing press and create something called a newspaper. So 400 years of maturity before that even occurred to anyone to do.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in such infancy with the internet and social media that give it time. I think it will settle out. And I think that which is in our best interest will rise up, if not by law, then certainly culturally.
Sure.
And we try to do what's good for the world.
I hope so.
We always try to do.
But there is some sort of a cultural Moore's law that I think applies, especially the way we use technology, where we expect things to never in history do I think people have ever expected things to evolve as quickly. Even just like new iPhone. Well, I got to have a new one.
Yeah.
We just had I got to have a new one. You know, it's like, what's the new thing? What's the new feature? What's this new thing? The expectation of evolution is so demanding.
But I don't think that's bad. My 20-year-old daughter, who you've met, would not make that complaint.
I'm not complaining. I'm just saying
she won't even make that observation. This is life.
Well, because she doesn't know any other
way. Okay, she buys white. That's what I'm saying. They're born into it.
Yeah.
So what are you saying?
What I'm saying is I think maybe it won't take 400 years because
of
the rate.
Of course. But I wanted to give that as an example of how creative people thought they were with a printing press, yet there was still something to invent 400 years later.
Exactly. It would take that long.
Exactly.
Well, even just the Dark Ages where – essentially nothing not a lot really advanced in that. I mean, I'm sure.
Not only that, they forgot some things that had come out of the Roman Empire.
I mean, there must just be large swaths of things that we just don't, that historically we just don't remember, things that just were lost.
Possibly, it's harder to completely lose knowledge because it's copied so many times and we have such good access to it. And with Google scanning every single book that was ever published. Do you realize that up until maybe early 1800s, I'd say maybe late 1700s, fully highly educated people had the chance of having been able to have read every single book ever published?
Oh, my God.
There's some transition point. Right. That's what I'm saying. So there's nothing to stop Google from scanning every one of those books and just catching up with modern times. Then you can search every single book. We're not going to lose fundamental knowledge going forward unless there's some kind of apocalypse. And as Albert Einstein noted, I don't know how World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones.
That's an amazing place. Yep. That is amazing place. That is an amazing place to wrap up. But it is always a pleasure to have you on this podcast. And anything you ever want to do, I feel like maybe we should do a recurring game with you where you record a bunch of stuff and we just drop it into the show.
We'll talk. Yeah, it could be fun just to stay on the edge.
I would totally be willing to do that. And there's a subreddit that I've really been enjoying lately called Ask Historians, and it's great. It's kind of no-nonsense. Like, the mods do not tolerate – like, you can't just post a joke. It's not like a typical subreddit where it's kind of evolves through comedy and silliness.
Have fun. Yeah.
It's like you have to be able to source your answer, and it can have a little bit of comedy in it, but it has to have substance.
Right.
And one of the questions that was on there today that was being answered was, did, for instance, the Roman Empire have an antiquities – did they understand antiquities? Did they have antiquities? Did they have that? And the answer that was rolling in kind of seemed to be, well, they
were fans of the Greeks.
They would
copied
have
copied all their statues.
Right. They would have even if they found stuff, they may not have necessarily known what to make of it or contextually like what it was. But that's a subreddit recommendation that you might enjoy because it's thoroughly, thoroughly knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm. And one bit of trivia for you. One of our guests this season is Terry Crews.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah. And we also interviewed his body, just so you know, because they're two separate. You have to contract separately to get to each one.
Exactly.
So we went to his man cave in downtown Los Angeles, interviewed him there. He has identical wallpaper to what you have in this recording studio.
He's got – really?
Yes.
Oh, he's got the identical – Stormtrooper, the Darth Vader.
Yeah, he's got the – it's Star Wars –
The Empire, basically. It's Empire.
Yeah, helmet. Star Wars helmet wallpaper.
Yeah,
so you've got a Jango Fett, or is that Boba Fett?
That's Boba Fett.
Boba Fett, and you've got the
got a stormtrooper.
Stormtrooper,
there,
and of course Darth Vader.
Darth Vader.
And who's the other guy that looks like an Easter Island head? What is that?
I don't know that one. That's one of the guys. If you watch the original Star Wars, they had like different delineations of
the stormtrooper soldier,
okay, and he was one of those guys.
All right,
thank you so much, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Pleasure as always, and the Star Talk podcast, which is still available.
Yeah, exactly. 50 we still do 50 of those a year. It's just the 20 that National Geographic lifts and puts on TV, but they all still go to the podcast and radio, Sirius XM Radio, channel 121 at 5 p.m.
Now,
Eastern time.
You may or may not remember this because we say at the end of the podcast, we say enjoy your burrito, which basically just means enjoy the present as you have it.
Is that why you have a burrito in the painting up there?
That's exactly
I did not understand.
Yeah,
that.
It means enjoy your present as it's happening. You know, it's sort of a way to tell people like don't get too caught in the past and the future, like live your life. Is there a scientific way, or is there some type of a mantra that you have, or that expresses the same idea?
Yes.
What is that?
Yes. While you were invited to reflect on the past and imagine a future, do not lose sight of the fact that we are prisoners in the present, forever transitioning from our past to our future.
I'm going to have to remember that for every episode now. That's beautiful. Thank you very much, Dr. Dyson.
We are prisoners of our present.
Go be prisoners of your present and celebrate it.
And get over it. And in that present, you can eat your burrito. Sorry. You cannot eat your burrito in the future. You can only eat it in the present.
You can only eat your burrito in the present.
Yes.
The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Hey, you. It's Jason Bateman. Have you listened to Smartless? Smartless is the podcast that I host with my friends who are more like brothers, the super talented and funny Will Arnett and Sean Hayes is...
Why are you whispering?
Well, there's a psst in the copy.
But people are listening, so it's like...
They are listening. Like, okay.
Yeah.
In each episode of Smartless, one of us reveals our mystery guest to the other two. What ensues is a genuinely improvised and authentic conversation. Our mystery guests span... Our mystery guests. All right, here we go.
We got a lot of big famous people from different walks of life. And if you're a Wondery fan, then you're going to...
Just come and listen to it.
Yeah. We're on Wondery right now, and you can listen to us. And no matter what you're doing, you're at the gym or you're in the car, just listen to the podcast.
Sean, tell them where they can find it.
Follow Smartless on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Bye.
Bye.